Chapter 4. Blessed are those who mourn. Part 2. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Over the grave, we hear the words of the speaker expressing memories about the departed one. Then, filled with commiseration for the bereaved, he seeks to comfort them with those sweet words that once were pronounced on the mountain. He tries to uplift them with that consolation, with that balm for the soul, his loving sympathy and his understanding looks. Indeed, he is successful. They do feel somewhat uplifted, and a little more light does come into their sorrowing hearts. It is probable that a similar kind of consolation has more than once been extended to you by some friend or kindred soul, and that it has lightened the sad burden which you had to carry. However, bear in mind that this grief is a natural result when grim and counter-natural death wrenches one of our loved ones away from us. So when some understanding and soulful friend stands by us in our grief with his consolation and loving thoughts, such mourning can never make us blessed. This comfort from a friend's heart, as good and as indispensable as it may be, has its limits. If blessedness resulted from such grief and consolation, the world would surely be filled with blessed ones, because death never passes by a single door. If blessedness were achieved by this method, death would be an infinitely better spiritual teacher than all the divine messengers combined, from the beginning of time until now. Therefore, we can say with certainty that our ordinary grief and sadness, although understandable, have nothing to do with the true meaning of blessedness. We would like to impress this thought on you because practically all theologians are of the opinion that this beatitude indeed has reference to the common forms of earthly adversity. That one can teach this in boundless superficiality is comprehensible, but how such a teaching can be upheld in the practice of real life is less clear. This shallowness and lack of intelligence may well be due to the platitudinizing and profaning of the concept of blessedness. In the Gnostic sense, blessedness is a state of highest recompense and the greatest felicity in spirit, soul, and body. Blessedness is absolute fullness of spiritual attainment and spiritual bliss. There is nothing that could be added. It is sufficient unto itself. It is everything. It is God Himself manifested in men. But in a churchy sense, blessedness is the state wherein the dead exist, a place where those who, after dying, are believed to be taken up into communion with God. At best, according to the concept of some churches, we may experience a foretaste of this blessedness if we live in accordance with the norms of the church. If we do so, we may gain a perspective of this ultimate blessedness while still living. Do you understand how such an idea profanes the concept of blessedness? For the Gnostic, it does not matter where he is. Blessedness can be fully experienced in the present, even when earthly adversity exists around us as a wall. With the religious earthly concept, blessedness becomes a speculation by means of which the churches throughout all ages have sidestepped the opposition of the masses. They say that you may be poor and miserable in this world. You may be injured and exploited. But your day to be blessed will come, if you will only listen to the theologians. The church will give you a certificate of blessedness and a reserved seat in heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Do you see the way by which people are made dumb as a result of such religious thinking? Can you see why certain groups in this world have always needed the church for their practices? Can you see why a Gnostic activity has therefore become a necessity now that the early light of a new sun is dispelling the clouds? The grief you experience in this nature, as understandable and self-evident as it may be, will never make you blessed. All the solace that you may receive from friends, kindred spirits, or spiritual leaders, though it may help you more or less to carry on without committing suicide. Though this comfort may have a warming effect to some degree in this cold world, still it is not absolute. Thanks to such solace, we may forget the spectre of grief for a moment, but it still remains and will pounce upon us again from time to time. We will bravely pull ourselves together in the face of our woe, but it will not in any way lessen the adversities inherent in this nature, and of blessedness, there will be none. Let us consider these things a little further. During the Second World War, an ocean of adversities beset us. Now none of us will attempt to claim that those calamities made us blessed. Who among us could relieve that awful suffering with comfort? Who could stir the least gleam of hope in the eyes with any kind of consolation? How can it be possible, under such terrible circumstances, that the dragnet for heaven was and still is being blindly and blissfully accepted and continued. How can it possibly be that in face of this desperate bankruptcy of the religious corporations, one still dares to offer man the promise of deferred blessedness? All such ideas become sardonic humour, provoking bitter ridicule when we read certain sermon titles in the paper or come across a poster saying, "Jesus saves, every Sunday at 2 o'clock. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." Our mourning, and indeed any mourning, with respect to this nature, cannot be read into this beatitude. It is not the consolation within the norms of this nature in thought, word, or deed, which results from such mourning that is meant in this beatitude. This is an established fact in the consciousness of any gnostically sensitive person. We think it well to dwell for a moment on humanism, the perspectives of which we reject. All humanism proceeds from the idea and the inner urge to allay the effects and causes of all calamities. All humanism springs from the consolatory motives which arise within us when we see the suffering of world and mankind. Humanism is that organized goodness which attempts to run evil down without ever being able to catch it. It is the endeavor of humanism to neutralize evil, but throughout all ages it has never succeeded. The ancient and lofty Chinese philosophy of thousands of years ago was already deeply convinced of this fact. The great Lao Tzu states clearly that all organized goodness results from the fact that man has left the true path, Tao. "Yes," says this great philosopher literally, "people then came stumbling and squirming to administer their charity, elbowing their way and standing on tiptoe to see justice done. The great Tao disappeared, and philanthropy and justice appeared. Sagacity and ingenuity came into existence and great hypocrisy." With incomparable depth and directness, Lao Tse puts the axe here to the root of human righteousness, no ledge and love. He unmasks the entire human order as a counter-natural monstrosity as compared to Tao. His words find their echo in the Bible, which says, "The wisdom of this world is foolishness with God." Now it is quite natural for a person with some degree of cultivated goodness, who realizes the great sorrow of mankind, to do his utmost spontaneously, out of an inner urge, to alleviate this sorrow and to remove the cause if he can. It is the reaction of goodness in this counter nature. Who would object if you choose to join the ranks of the humanists who, for centuries past, have made it their business to uplift their fellow men on their earthly pilgrimage? Moreover, objecting to this would be of little use, because the man of goodness, in so acting, is spurred on from an inner urge. He cannot very well do otherwise, because it is second nature to him. In fact, it is considered a proof of his own quality of goodness. However, this is not our main objection to humanism. We are even glad and ready to lend our support to every noble and necessary humanitarian endeavor. We are quite willing to accept the far-reaching consequences, and the spiritual community to which we belong has given ample evidence of such deeds throughout all ages. But this spiritual community has also made it plain throughout all ages that the most advanced and applied humanism, with all its idealistically religious aspects included, is of this nature and applicable to the norms of this nature, and therefore, unavoidably, it is the companion of evil. Humanism can bring no absolute blessedness and no absolute consolation. It does not put an end to death, nor can it remove the cancer from our bodies. Yet, it still does have a task to fulfill in our civilization, because it will ultimately do away with the social, political, and economic anarchy of these times. But after that, what will happen? Eventually, it will become apparent that absolute blessedness and consolation cannot be procured by humanism, and that the dismal sorrows of this nature will persist in a multitude of new forms. Mankind has already known many humanized civilizations in prehistoric times, but they perished because the law of this nature is dialectical. If you do not understand this, if you are unable to think so deeply, then you will discover it in the school of experience. We say, be spontaneously humane by virtue of your nature. Do not shirk humanistic work whenever it comes your way, insofar as it provides an opportunity directly and truly to heal wounds which have resulted from the disorder of the time. However, look at all this as a natural line of conduct springing from your state of being, all the while fully realizing that the distant kingdom of which Jesus Christ taught, Tao is not of this world, is not of this nature. That along with the natural humanism, which can never liberate us from this nature, you must also possess an entirely different state of consciousness, another state of soul and body, which is not of this world. We must focus our entire reasoning on this fact, because all other reasoning is only reflex activity. A person who has risen above this nature in Jesus the Lord is humane in this nature simply because suffering confronts him, but he does not consider such action as liberating or essential. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, if the God-man speaking on the mountain is not a demagogue, if blessedness cannot arise from sorrow, if consolation cannot take away that sorrow, nor protect man from ever-progressing afflictions, what must we consider as the true meaning of this beatitude in order that it reaches the level of God's word, which transmits eternity to us? There is a kind of mourning, a sorrow which cannot be explained from this nature. This sorrow is and will continue to be experienced by those who are worthy to be lifted up to the mountain of the Beatitudes, by those who, in the name of the distant kingdom, are active in this nature with a view to bringing about the great spiritual revolution, the regeneration unto the light, unto Tao, unto calling humanity by pointing out mankind's true task of goodness, truth, and justice. There is a host of workers scattered throughout the world, exerting themselves to the utmost to etch the principle of divine nature into mankind of this nature. This work causes an intense sorrow and sadness, because these workers experience what an uphill task such work presents, and how very slowly it makes any progress. The results they obtain bear not the least proportion to the colossal effort spent. There is no question of mourning as a result of natural sorrow. There is no question here of mourning for departed relatives or kindred spirits. One does not refer to the afflictions of this world that most frequently elicit grief and sadness. No, there is an intense sorrow because the workers desire to offer freely the greatest spiritual and liberating treasures together with a divine grace, a redeeming knowledge which contains the key to the true meaning of our lives. Now, those to whom they address themselves most often grind their heels on their offerings and refuse their gifts, experiencing their work as inconvenient and disturbing to one's peace of mind. These workers grieve because they find the consciousness of so many is too primitive, and their blood too thick, and their eyes too darkened to be able to perceive and assimilate, because they must stand by and see how people trample and tear one another ruthlessly to pieces to gain their own ends, and how they chase after all sorts of shadows that the world has to offer, while in ignorance they ignore the one thing necessary. Be sure that you understand this correctly. The sorrow meant here is not the one produced by opposition and its results, owing to the pain that unavoidably accompanies the holy work. It is the sorrow that man cannot see his true happiness because of his defective faculty of assimilation and the devices of his eye consciousness. This is sorrow that wells up from absolute love which is spurned. It is the sorrow of the Christ, the veil of mourning that was spread over his Jesus manifestation. It is the sorrow of Jesus Christ when, standing on the Mount of Olives and lifting up his hands, he cried, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I wanted to gather you, as a hen gathers her brood, but you did not want it." Blessed are those who mourn thus, for they shall be comforted. Blessedness is a state of the highest contentment and the greatest happiness. When the words are spoken on the mountain by Jesus Christ, by the Christ vibration of our day, "Blessed are those who mourn," then we know that the cause of our mourning shall be removed, that the veil of sadness which envelops us shall be rent, and that our work shall attain from within the highest recognition and supreme happiness. The workers in the vineyard then know that blessedness is to be born in, through, and of their work. Then the blessedness is not just individual experience, but it has become impersonal, for it includes the absolute happiness and liberating attainment of many. Now this is the consolation that surpasses all sorrow. This is the divine humanism. This is the love of God, which surpasses all understanding. Blessedness exists now, in the present, and will exist in the future. It is a state of advancement, resulting from true liberating work. It is a process of growing. Therefore, anyone who mourns has already received many evidences of blessedness in his life, whenever on the path of service he could cause a human soul to come to the light. As this reality of blessedness is not as yet in balance with the results of his work, consolation is given, the divine consolation which comes again and again to put new heart into the tired and battle-scarred worker, to inspire him with fresh energy, so that he may keep on toiling with his head raised toward giving birth to the new reality, the eternal Tao. Blessed are those who mourn, they shall be comforted. This is the second state of being on the path of service.